Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. George Orwell had a way with words and the ideas that drive them so great that his own name became one of the most powerful descriptors of our time. Say Orwellian, and heads will nod around the planet. Frequently quoted and more frequently misunderstood, Orwell has been alternately criticized and embraced by both the right and the left for his unwavering eye. He foresaw the threat of radical totalitarianism in 1984, the pitfalls of communism in Animal Farm. I knew I had a facility with words, Orwell wrote, and a power for facing unpleasant facts. It's this truth-seeking morality, the unabashed conviction that makes Orwell so relevant in his time and ours. It matters not what you think, but how you think, says our guest tonight, Christopher Hitchens. Politics are relatively unimportant, while principles have a way of enduring. Does George Orwell still matter today in America, in the world? What would Orwell say about American superpower, about the war on terror, about Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein's way with the truth? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Joining me tonight from Washington is Christopher Hitchens, author of Why Orwell Matters. Good evening and welcome, Christopher Hitchens.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Good to have you. And with us from New York is tonight's On Point news analyst, Amity Schlaes, senior columnist for the Financial Times. Hello, Amity.
Hello.
Christopher Hitchens, your book is out, and we understand your admiration for this man. Give us, if you'd be good enough, the thumbnail on George Orwell. Who was he?
Well, to do a bio thumbnail, he was an Englishman born 100 years ago next year. I mean, next year will be his centennial, in other words. To a colonial military, very conservative family, and educated at sort of traditional, as we call them, you know, brutal English boarding schools.
His father had been in the opium trade, you write.
His father was, yes, with the particularly delicious bit of British imperialism, which consisted of making the Chinese buy opium made in British India. I always think of it, whenever I think about the war on drugs, I remember the Imperial War for drugs. He skipped university, as a lot of people did in those days, probably for economic reasons, went to be a colonial policeman in Burma, and really his life begins with his decision to give that up, to refuse the job of being a cop, and to become a writer with no prospects. I mean, he never had any money, he never had a regular publishing outlet, never had a good publisher or a reliable magazine even to appear in, and spent a lot of his time in the lower depths, going native, as it used to be called, in his own country and in France. His first stuff was actually published in French, quintessentially English, though he may have been.
And not under the name George Orwell?
No, under his given name, his birth name of Eric Blair. Mm-hmm. He didn't change to Orwell till the 1930s. And then he had a very decidedly radical and leftist view of the world, of, not just of the empire, but of the class system at home, and set himself against it, went to fight in Spain against fascism as an early volunteer. And while in Spain, I realized that the great illusion of the left, excuse me, about Soviet communism as the alternative was more than an illusion. It was a really dangerous lie.
Where he saw how the uprising there was manipulated.
He saw the democratic revolution in Spain, particularly in Catalonia, being crushed by Stalin's agents, and we now know he was luckier than he realized. He knew he'd been targeted, but he was luckier than he realized to get away with his life from that. And he devoted the last years of his life, really, to writing polemics and very well-known novelistic satires, warning people of the dangers of Stalinism, without ever actually giving up any of his other radical and egalitarian and internationalist positions. So my preferred thumbnail of him is that of the three great questions of the last century, the 20th century, which were the end of empire, the end of the right of white Europeans to rule the world, the battle against fascism and national socialism, and the battle against Stalinism, only one public intellectual, as we would now say, only one individual writer or writerly voice got all these three questions correct and did so with what you nearly described rightly, but I just want to correct a tiny thing you said. You said what he said was a power of facing. It's an odd way of phrasing it, which has always attracted me. He didn't say a power to face or a power
for
facing. A power of facing. It's idiosyncratic.
But looking straight in, looking straight into it.
Looking, that's right, straight down the gun barrel unblinkingly. And he had that and a typewriter and a sort of attitude, and an attitude above all to the relationship between language and truth, which means that he's still read by people to whom these old disputes may seem remote, though of course they've may very much shaped the world we now live in.
What
they
you
still
say-
seem remote, but people who don't care about them or even don't know about them, I think can guess, and what I try and bring out in my book is that it is guessable that a certain commitment to intellectual honesty is what's required, and moral courage. And with those two things, you can think, my God, it seems that everyone else thinks one thing and only I think the other, but I might be right and they might all be wrong.
Even if I'm thinking this alone. Christopher Hitchens, you famously pluck the eyeballs out of people that you disagree with, but you clearly kind of worship at the Orwell temple here. Is it just that courage before the gun barrel that puts you in that position?
Well, before you go on, one, I don't quite accept the grammar of your question. I know it's kindly meant. I don't mind the bit about plucking the eyeballs, but I've deliberately written this book against Orwell worship. I mean, there is a cult of him as a sort of goody-goody, as a plaster saint, and so on. And I think he's often taught in school in that way.
Well, and we fully acknowledge that, but yet you take on all of his intellectual challenges here.
I'm opposed to that, but at least it does give me an answer to a question I do sometimes get asked, oddly enough, by people, which is, well, isn't there anyone you like? I can say, well, yes, funnily enough, there is.
But here's Orwell.
Here at least is the gold standard of the sort of thing I think that should be admired in an age of bogus celebrities and amoral criminals and the other sorts of people who tend to get love and attention these days.
You entitled the book, I think in the UK it was Orwell's Victory. In the US it's Why Orwell Matters.
I hate both the titles.
Well, but there they are, right in the book, and you which leads us to ask, I guess, the thing that most Americans will first associate with George Orwell is the kind of 1984 vision of radical totalitarianism. That 1984 state, in the last year, I mean, in every generation, almost in every year, someone is accusing some government around the world, the American or otherwise, of exemplifying that. In the last year, that concern has risen with the Patriot Act and all of the kickback and security measures taken against terrorism. Where do you see the most justified concern about the kind of 1984 state of affairs in the year 2002?
Well, Orwell was very useful, not just in warning against that kind of hermetic state, but also in warning us to watch out for abuses of language, and especially the ways of making nasty things sound pretty. So a term like, say, collateral damage to mean dead civilians would have immediately grabbed his attention. And I'm pleased to say that, you know, whenever terms like that are used, there's always someone willing to write to the papers and say, you know,
Orwellian.
Obviously, they haven't read their Orwell, exactly. I think it would be by a gigantic stretch that people described even the most crude measures taken by Attorney General Ashcroft as Orwellian in the sense of a regime of total surveillance based on the convincing application of total fear. I mean, the fact is that would be a hysterical thing to say, and it would leave nothing to be said of a situation of which it was true. So it's always a mistake for that reason to start saying, you know, the brown shirts have come. What are you going to say when they really come?
But is there a live 1984 wire today?
I'm one of the few journalists who can say this. I've been to two of the three axis of evil states.
Those being?
As they were rather, I thought, crudely denominated by the president. Well, the three being Iran, Iraq, and North Korea.
Mm-hmm. And you were two. We know North Korea is one.
In the case of North Korea, the truth of the matter is, I mean, you can't possibly exaggerate the extent to which it's as if the Kim Il-sung and his son actually modeled their state on a reading of George Orwell. They thought, would this work? Could we get people to behave like that if we ground them down hard enough? And It's quite impossible to exaggerate. The only comparable place I have been to is Iraq, where the fear, as a friend of mine wrote recently, is so intense and so strong and so pervasive that you can eat it. I mean, you have to have felt that kind of everyday, round-the-clock, nightmarish terror, where people are just afraid to talk to each other, to their own families, to any foreigner, and where their reasons for that fear are very, very well grounded and constantly reminded. They're constantly reminded of them. Mm. But it's not. It's even so. Nothing quite touches Kim Il Sung. However, you know, that's another way of showing how relevant the writing of Mr. Orwell remains.
Amity Schles, I want to bring you in. Have we been so well forewarned by George Orwell of those totalitarian dangers that 1984 is a kind of a slur in or against America today? Is there relevance in the United States, or is it really toward Baghdad we should properly look, as Christopher Hutchins suggests?
Well, I think we've been pretty well forewarned in one measure of a society. Maybe you could call it the Orwell Index. If a society can debate Orwell happily, then a society is not in danger of those things Orwell described and feared. When you look at what Orwell said about wars, when he decided they were good wars, right wars, he was behind them. In World War II, he said pacifism is objectively pro-fascist, as Christopher wrote. He attacked pacifists who did not support England in World War II once the engagement had happened and once, you know, when the Soviet Union was lined up with Germany. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to anticipate. Orwell was an opportunistic philosopher in a positive sense. First, he looked at the opportunity, the experience, and then he evaluated it. So it's hard to know what he would have made of the situation today. He didn't really anticipate it.
Christopher Hitchens, when you see the war on terror is described as perpetual, you describe Saddam Hussein's regime as being a kind of personification of one kind of totalitarianism and severe. Would Orwell have been at the barricades? Would he have said, this is the call to arms, all right-thinking people need to stand up and support this war on terror?
Well, not in those terms. No, he wouldn't, because he had a great reluctance for conscription, for mobilization, for patriotic fervor, for the banging of the drum, all that kind of thing. He had a natural resistance to it, partly because of his experience of empire and war. So, no. But I might add that, by the way, 1984 is a description not just of a society that is completely regimented and controlled and terrified, but of a world that is regularly kept in order by the continuous threat of war and by shifting alliances. That's how the regime maintains control. So there's always a reason to be skeptical about any country that seems to use war and threat as a means of political discipline.
And yet, as Amity points out...
And in fact, he also, but incidentally, it's quite clear from a reading of it that 1984 takes place in a world which has survived at least a limited nuclear exchange and has been devastated and beggared and terrorized to that extent, too. He was very pessimistic when he died about the future. And he is the man who coined the phrase Cold War. It's definitely, one can't always be sure about attributions and original coinages, but you can in this case. The phrase is first used by Orwell, and it's used negatively to mean a state of affairs where superpowers can run the world between them while pretending to quarrel, where in fact they have almost as much in common as they have, including, say, the willingness to destroy everybody, as they have differences between them. I personally think that was an important insight about the Cold War, even though there were distinctions, important ones, to be made between the regimes.
Amity, what do you think? Did you see Orwell with a call to arms in the War on Terror?
Well, the fact remains that he worked in the propaganda office in World War II, and he did work on the Home Guard, as Christopher notes in his book. So he did get jingoistic. He might have been ambivalent and perceptive about it, but he did get jingoistic. The one aspect of the current situation that has echoes, at least for me, in Orwell's work, is his understanding of mass hatred, when a crowd can be worked up into an insane fervor of hatred of an individual. And that does bring to mind what we see in the Middle East when you see crowds going crazy in their hatred of the U.S. or the West. He described that very frighteningly in The Moment of Hate, when everyone hated Emmanuel Goldstein in 1984. They got up and they vilified this character in a mass hate session.
After the attacks on the West Bank.
Well, no. I'm talking about 1984.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The 19 and that mass hatred, a portrait of anti-Semitism,
right,
is familiar today.
Right there. We're talking tonight about George Orwell and the way we live now. Why are we still talking about Orwell 50 years after his death, 18 years after 1984? Join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about George Orwell and the way we live now. Our guest is Christopher Hitchens. He's author of a new book, Why Orwell Matters, and a columnist for Vanity Fair. Does Orwell still matter? Which face of Orwell matters to you? Are we in Orwell's world of newspeak and doublethink? And did reading 1984 inoculate the United States against sliding into its own 21st century version, or are things not that easy? You can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Christopher Hitchens, this word imperialism has come back in the year since 9/11. There are people who even speak of it with some fondness now, or in even a kind of white man's burden tone again about nation building and projecting power into troubled portions of the world. How do you imagine if that troubled portion is, let's say, Iraq, which you describe as Orwellian in its system of government? How do you imagine George Orwell dealing with that tension, two of his bugaboos on the table at once?
Yes, well, the test of anyone is, I suppose, how they handle contradiction. And I think he would have been surprised. I mean, he did think that the age of empire was over. He was, on the whole, glad of it. Well, he was indeed glad of it and fought for it, fought for self-government and independence. He never said that, because he'd been a colonial civil servant himself, he never said that it was entirely bad. He knew there were some things, say, in India, that the British had done right. I mean, I would instance, I suppose, the building of railways, the coming of the printing press, a certain concept of the civil service and so forth, and of objectivity in the law, which India preserves and doesn't deny. It owes partly, at any rate, to the collision with empire, but it outgrew it. What happens when you get, you know, a state that is partly parasitic on empire? I mean, after all, Saddam Hussein used to be an imperial client, just as he's now an imperial foe, someone who is aggressive, who has a totalitarian ideology. We are in new territory here. I think that the only justification that can be made for the policy of regime change, to which I'm personally sympathetic, is this, that it takes a bet that the Iraqi people, if they were relieved of this hideous regime, which is partly foreign-imposed and has been partly foreign-imposed, would on their own come up with a better society and a better system of government.
So a means and ends issue arises here.
Well, yes. I mean, after all, up until now, the United States in that region has been ruling by a sort of Nixon doctrine through client states, such as Saudi Arabia or Pakistan, which turned out to be treacherous and resentful and reactionary, and in fact to have incubated our worst enemies. So the feeling among at least some of us who favor the regime change option is, well, why not empower the locals? Help them, as it were, to self-government. This is not exactly imperialism. There may be an element of, what shall I call it? I'm looking for the right word. Paternalism to it, I suppose. But
it's a short
jump
sometimes.
The idea is that the Iraqis who are already fighting against and have for a long time been fighting against Saddam Hussein would be the winners, just as in Afghanistan, those who fought against the Taliban and the women and others who resisted it now have a better chance to run their own show. They're not living in a garrison state. Afghanistan, I don't think, could properly be described as a colony.
So that's a different goal if you're not looking at building an empire of colonizing.
I don't want to idealize it. I mean, I think there are many possible drawbacks and misgivings to have, but at its best, it could be defended in that way by someone like myself whose background is that of a socialist and an internationalist.
Amity Schley's George Orwell was famously attuned to the seductions of power.
Yes. Well, I think it's interesting, though, that Christopher and I agree on this issue of the future of the Middle East. That I don't know what Orwell would have made of it, but it's interesting that you get to a point where across the U.S., spectrum, you have people agreeing.
A voice from the left, a voice from the right, perhaps.
A voice,
saying,
I'm supposed to be a voice from the right here, agreeing on regime change in the context of what we know about intellectual history and Orwell.
I'll tell you one thing where he and I would agree and you would not straight away, though, which is very important. he wrote consistently throughout the 40s and the last decade of his life that he was sure that the Zionist movement, for whatever its moral justification was from what had happened to the Jewish people in Europe, was going to involve doing a terrible injustice to the Palestine Arabs. He never wavered on that, even though the magazine where he worked, Tribune, had a largely Jewish staff.
Well, Christopher,
he said, "You know, this is definitely an undoubted injustice to the Palestinians. It's going to lead to a lot of conflict." And the memoirs of his friends who used to disagree with him at that time, Tosco Fievel in particular, say they wished they'd listened to him.
Emily Slaves, do you part ways at that point on Mideast policy?
Well, I think in that regard, maybe Orwell still was an old imperialist. He was in the Arabist tradition of the United Kingdom.
I would say
that was his old-fashioned side. But in the context of his work, this whole issue of the Middle East, the future was seen in the imperialist or overcoming the imperialist context. The state of Israel, as we know it today, for example, was not something that he could have judged, since he wasn't really around for that. Just like he couldn't probably have judged Islamic fundamentalism, or he couldn't have judged the arrival of the computer chip. You know, these are things that were ahead, and he was so great in that he responded to what there was, and honestly.
Christopher Hitchens, you describe how Orwell was seen as an enemy, an important and frightening enemy, by both the left and at times by the right. How could that be, and why the left in particular?
Well, I don't think... Well, your question is really about the left, as you just said. So the right, I can't say they felt frightened by him. I mean, he just thought of the right.
Well, the old imperialist right must
right
have been...
The British ruling class, so he just thought of them as his natural enemy. I don't know if he ever terrified them enough. He certainly... Mm-hmm. Wrote a lot of things ridiculing them and helped to mobilize, you know, the left press in Britain at a time, which, you know, in the end, those struggles in the 30s and 40s did eventuate in a Labour government in 1945.
And the left?
But as for the left, it's much easier to tell why he was and still is disliked there, because having never been attracted to communism at any stage in his life, having not had any Stalinist illusions to live down, he wrote from very early on that he thought there was something really ghastly going on in the Soviet Union and among its subordinate and satellite communist parties in the rest of the world. And for that, he was accused of essentially giving ammunition to the enemy, you know, of not being a team player, of raising crucial doubts at a time when everyone thought, well, let's forget all that for now and get together in the battle against Hitler or Franco or whoever it is. Obviously, that, by the way, at the time was a very powerful argument. Mm. Closing ranks against Nazism is not a weak argument, but he thought, no, that's closing ranks on something that you can't have closed ranks about, because you're supposed to believe in that case that Stalinism is not just a tactical ally, but you know, is the model of what a future society would be like. And that was a lie he refused to tell or to pass on or to give any credit to.
And why was he so feared for that?
I'm sorry?
Why was he so particularly feared for that? Why was his voice so unnerving to contemporaries on the left?
Well, can I just add that I think that the fortitude with which he did this came from the fact that he'd been brought up in an English public school and colonial and military tradition where that's exactly the argument by which dissent is crushed. You know, you mustn't talk in front of the servants. You mustn't raise doubts in front of the natives.
Keep up appearances.
Exactly. So he knew already that it was that the essence of that kind of means and mode of argument was dishonest, and that it was usually, by the way, the sign of a bad conscience. It was that there were things that you couldn't afford to admit or discuss, had to be kept secret. So he had, paradoxically, because he'd had this conservative background, he was very able to see through it when that sort of what is in a sense jingoistic and chauvinistic talk was used as a cloak by people on the left who ought to have known, and some of them may have indeed known better, but they thought for reasons of their own it would be inconvenient to be honest at that particular moment.
If you can't talk about the ugly side of Stalinism,
yeah,
there's a problem.
It's a standing reproach to all the people who compromised as well as all the people who actually believed. Mm-hmm.
Christopher Hitchens, Amity Slaves, stand by. A lot of people want to join our conversation. Let's invite them in. Melanie's on the line. Hi, Melanie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment about my favorite concept of Orwell and his term doublethink.
Yes.
I think you used it earlier in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one thing that is so genius about that term is that it's not just about doublespeak. It's about doublethink, which implies a certain collusion on the part of the public to kind of go along with what they're being told. And I think that there are some examples of that now, especially where Bush calls this pending war with Iraq as, and also the war on terrorism, as a war for liberty. Yet, in order to pursue this, we're definitely siding and relying with many dictators.
So, Melanie, I want to be sure I get you straight. You then are seeing this Orwellian element in U.S. foreign policy.
Well, yes. And also, I think there's also a tendency, I think, of the public to kind of bury their heads in the sand because it is these are complicated issues. It's hard to figure out what the root causes of things are. It's easy to just kind of accept what we're being told because to dig into the truth is hard, and it's also we may find things that we don't really want to find out.
Christopher Hitchens, let me put it to you, and Melanie, thank you for your call. There are really two things here. One, you've written about how Orwell observed the attraction even of slavery at a certain way and the seduction or collusion that can take place. Melanie then takes that and applies it to the contemporary American scene around the Bush White House.
Well, I want to sympathize with the question, but here's why I don't. You're right, by the way. He was very interested in the power relationship and in the awful way in which many people secretly want to be told what to do, the sort of masochism that you get. Why was it that the British working class was so easy to control? Why did they demand so little? Why were they so inclined to touch their caps to the authorities and be grateful for little they got? And why was it so easy for the British to keep the Burmese in a kind of sexual servitude as well as an economic one, you know, using their women in their bungalows but not letting their men join the English club, that kind of thing. He was interested. He'd seen the power relationship, what Nietzsche calls the master-slave relationship from both sides, and he knew there was a kind of pornographic secret at the heart of power, which is what makes his fiction as well as his journalism so powerful. But I don't think he would have had any patience with your last questioner in the way that she phrased it. I hope I don't do her an injustice. There were people in 1940 who said, okay, the Germans behave very badly in Poland, but the British Empire behaves very badly in India. Orwell said, well, that frankly is just ducking the question. Unless you believe the two things are equivalent and there's nothing worth fighting for between the two, which was secretly believed by some of the people who said that, said it would be a dishonest comparison. And by the way, he was saying that as the person who, all through the war and all through the 20s and 30s, was very alone in saying India should be independent anyway, whether it wants to join the war or not. We can't make it do so on our side. We have no right to. But he wouldn't have compared British rule in India to Nazi rule in Poland. And he wouldn't have made it an excuse for looking away from what Nazi rule in Poland was really doing. And if your caller really wants to say, well, why do people sometimes not want to confront things? Why do people look away? She could probably do no better than look at the way that people don't want it to be true that Saddam Hussein is as wicked as he evidently is. Because if it's true that he's not only as aggressive but as cruel and ruthless and irrational as he seems, then that's an awful truth, because it would mean we'd have to do something about it. So many people, not wishing to do anything about it, kind of forgive themselves for thinking, well, maybe it's not really true.
Truth there. At the same time, it strikes me that Orwell perhaps trained us in part to keep keep two perhaps contrary thoughts in mind simultaneously. Maybe there needs to be something Saddam, and yet at the same time to be suspicious of rhetoric from leaders, even on our home turf.
Oh, indeed, but some things can be true, as it were, even though George Bush says they're true.
Yeah. Amity Schles, I think you plucked up a passage from Orwell that I hope you'll share with us on this point of power, the power we may be picking up soon in Iraq that Saddam holds now in Iraq.
The abuse of power and the sense of what happens when there is a crowd. Yes, it's from Shooting an Elephant. And you'll recall he was a young police official in Burma, and an elephant goes on a rampage. And in that culture, the rule was that the white authority was supposed to come and shoot the mad elephant with a gun.
Deal with it.
He didn't want to shoot the elephant. But as he approaches, a crowd of 2,000 locals gather behind him, and they want him to shoot the elephant. And because of that pressure, he does. And he says, I waited a long time for him to die, but his breathing did not weaken. Finally, I fired my two remaining shots in the spot where I thought his heart must be. It seemed dreadful to see the great beast lying there, powerless to move and yet powerless to die. I sent back for my small rifle and poured shot after shot into his heart. In the end, I could not stand it any longer and went away. Afterwards, of course, he writes, there were endless discussions about the shooting of the elephant. Legally, I had done the right thing. A mad elephant has to be controlled like a mad dog. But he also writes, and this is the important phrase, I often wondered whether any of the others grasped that I had done it solely to avoid looking like a fool. That's the danger that we face. Do we do violence crap because the crowd forced us to it in the frenzy of the moment?
Christopher Hitchens.
It is one of the best of his essays and one of the most vivid, because English people used to say, well, think about Asians, you know, they hate to lose face. And what they meant, it was literal transference. English people hated to lose face in front of Asians. I don't get the impression now that there is a mob demand in the United States for a war with Iraq. To the contrary, in fact, I think most people
more or less
regularly report in that they would willingly be spared this confrontation and would rather, much rather be told by the administration that actually Saddam Hussein is easily containable and we don't have to bother with it, or that it's, you know, being taken care of. So in this case, at any rate, I don't feel that there's a, as there was in, say, 1914, with sort of cheering crowds filling the streets of London and demanding war over Belgium. You know, the government is being swept away.
Let's get one quick call before the break. John's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hello. Earlier, Amity compared Arab extremists in their rallies to the 2 minutes of hate in the United States to Emmanuel Goldstein. I think another fitting analogy would be Osama bin Laden himself. I mean, he's, you know, used as a figurehead for all of Al-Qaeda, and he's almost become a semi-mythic figure. We don't know if he's dead or alive. And I think it's important to remember that in 1984, the situation with the world, with East Asia, Eurasia, and Oceania, is that it was a system of mutual hatred. And if you ignore one side and think that, you know, one side is bad and the other side is good, it may not be a good-bad situation. It may be a bad-bad situation in which nobody is really in the right, you know?
So you risk running into this kind of perpetual standoff. Christopher Hitchens, John, thank you for your call. Christopher Hitchens.
Well, Emmanuel Goldstein is based on the figure of Leon Trotsky, for whom Orwell had a guarded admiration, and whose mere existence, because he spoke about an alternative and published a critique and organized dissent, whose mere existence, physical existence, was a threat to Stalin, which was eventually, as we know, physically removed by a terrorist assassination of not just Leon Trotsky, but of all of his family and many, many thousands of his supporters. Trotsky never had on his conscience, I would say this, no matter what you think about his role as commander of the Red Army in the Russian Civil War, he never had on his conscience anything like the deliberate murder in the name of God of thousands of civilians, or the attempt to install a Stone Age theocratic despotism in Afghanistan, where women were chattel and where Shia Muslims, for example, for being the wrong kind of Islamists, were put to the sword.
Christopher, standby.
You don't need to invent anything about Osama bin Laden.
It's there right now. We're talking tonight about George Orwell and the way we live now. Do you remember the first time you read Burmese Days, Homage to Catalonia? Have they stuck with you? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about George Orwell and the way we live now. Our guest joining us tonight from Washington is Christopher Hitchens, author of the new book, Why Orwell Matters. And from New York, tonight's news analyst, Amity Schley, senior columnist for the Financial Times. Are these Orwellian times? And who's in what role now? What would George Orwell have made of the globe-straddling American superpower? Would he have welcomed it or feared it? Listeners, get into the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. John's calling from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
How are you?
Well, thanks.
I'd like to say that I think both the Iraqi regime and the regime in the United States are Orwellian in the sense that both are engaged in massive deceptions of the population, but there is a difference. The Iraqi dictator is a tin horn dictator, really without much power. gauged by the atrocities he's performed, he's basically second league compared to the United States.
And the U.S. is a superpower, but what massive distortion would you lay at the feet of Washington?
Well, for example, there's so many dictators in the world that we support. The idea that Saddam Hussein is a Hitler and is much more dangerous than any other is simply not true. And I think that the Orwellian regime in Baghdad is much less sophisticated than the one here, when the one here can get nominal opponents of the powers that be, like Christopher Hitchens, to support their war.
You've been seconded, Christopher Hitchens.
That would be a very reassuring test of its Orwellian capacity, I must say. I mean, since I'm a volunteer in this, and since I was against the Saddam Hussein regime, even when all members of the Bush family were on its side, I think I can, with some confidence, say that I haven't been conscripted into anything. I'm neither rewarded nor punished, wouldn't be, whichever choice I made. If you, as I hope you do, visit a fine bookstore soon to buy my Orwell book, you might want to pick up my Henry Kissinger one, too, which charges him with crimes which I must say I do think in scale and over time do eclipse those of Saddam Hussein.
But in John's comment...
But it could be said for the United States, however, that Henry Kissinger had to conduct all those policies in secret by lying to Congress, by lying to the press, by undermining, in fact, by violating the United States Constitution. It's nice to know, at least, that he thought enough of us to be unable to confess in public what he was doing, and for that revelation not to be able to survive the light of day or even local or international law, which is slowly catching up with him. This does not apply, I think you'll find, to the daily life of an Iraqi dissident or person wishing to ventilate a disagreement with the regime, and I think it's frivolous of you to say, or even to imply, that there is such a resemblance. By the way, since you say there are so many equivalent dictators to Saddam Hussein around the place, supported by the United States, I wonder which you think they are. I mean, apart from Saudi Arabia, which is very nearly a totalitarian system, which also opposes regime change in Iraq very strongly, I don't think I can think of one.
Christopher Hitchens, John is gone. We've lost him. But let me ask you off of that. And
well,
John, thank you for your call.
The question was to him, but it was for anyone.
Understood. But I wonder if you see, you spent a lot of time in the United States, if you see a way in which this Orwell skepticism about power has somehow married up perfectly with a Native American skepticism about power. I mean, it seems to always be there. The readiness to look at American power and bring up the issue of Orwellian manipulation.
Well, look, there's a long tradition of American skepticism about power, particularly as wielded overseas. A long argument as to whether the United States should be a republic and or an empire, about internationalism versus isolationism, and so forth. That's why, in my opinion, though I think that the last caller would have identified himself as to the left of George Bush, most of the solid, really convincing, last-ditch effective opposition to regime change in Iraq comes from the right.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. I mean, Bush.
Let's stay out of that business.
Bush doesn't care.
Oh,
people
wait,
like
wait,
Dash
wait a minute.
People. They're either the isolationist anti-Israeli right, like to put it mildly, like Pat Buchanan, or the what I would think of as the sort of imperial Tory faction, like Brent Scowcroft, Lawrence Eagleburger, Henry Kissinger, the people who like the status quo.
Emily Slate, you don't think so? You don't see that bastion of skepticism on that front?
Not quite. Defend U.S. foreign policy generally in the post-war period. It may have done some evil, but net it was good, and it helped bring down the communism, that communism that Orwell also hated. It's not comparable to Iraq.
But you know what I'm talking about, Amity? When you see that the word comes up again and again, it's always there. That somehow Americans have glommed on to Orwell's skepticism, fear, loathing of totalitarianism, and are willing to use it as a poker to push back within this country almost any time.
I think it's always good to be skeptical about your government's policy, especially when it's going into a war. That's the mark of a free society. So there's nothing unusual in that, Tom.
No, indeed. We also have Orwell's own words on this, because he knew that he was dying when 1984 came out. Mm-hmm. And Animal Farm had already been published. But he knew that in the United States there were many people who said, this is a great critique, this book, of what life would be like if the New Deal went on for another 5 years, or if the British Labour government succeeded in getting a National Health Service going. I mean, he knew that the book was being used by the most vulgar conservatives for the most self-evident Cold War purposes at home and abroad, and he wrote a special denunciation of that interpretation and abuse of it, which he published in his lifetime. It's one of the last things he did. Mm.
Kyle is on the line. Hi, Kyle. You're on the air.
Hey, good evening, and thank you. It's easy to rally around 1984 and Animal Farm and Burmese Days. They're all classics. There's one that's flown under the radar forever. Coming Up for Air, I'm not exactly sure the year he wrote it. I thought it was in the early 50s. But Coming Up for Air is one of those unknown Orwell books that, despite the fact that I used it as a title of a radio show I did in Alaska Public Radio, it seemed to describe this ennui of American or British culture where people just get their noses down in the daily grind and they don't even look up to find out what's going on in the rest of the world. It seems like, there's been this amazing American shift of where are these people? What are they doing? Give me a map. Tell me what's going on. And Coming Up for Air was one of those things that you saw why no one knows what's going on outside of their little plot. And I'd love to hear either of your guys have to say about it.
Let's hear it. Thanks for your call, Carl. Christopher Hitchens, Coming Up for Air.
Well, I'm thrilled that someone mentions that because of his social novels, of the ones that aren't political allegories. That and Keep the Asperdistra Flying are, I think, the best. They're my favorites. And they do describe, with some affection still for the quality of England and of the English, the terrible lives, the narrow, crushed, constrained lives, people fearful of what their superiors think of them, fearful of what their inferiors might do to them if they got the chance, and unable to sort of raise their muzzles from the trough for long enough to realize that they're being led by the nose towards another terrifying war. And he summons that atmosphere, as well as with a wonderful nostalgia for a more happy and peaceful pre-First World War English society, very, very well. And it's amazing to me to think that he wrote it while in Morocco, where he was trying to recuperate from the lung disease that in the end killed him. That he managed to evoke this atmosphere of Britain, but also, yes, the appalling smallness of the lives that were led in those days. And people forget this, you know, but in the 1930s, something like 10 million of members of the British workforce were domestic servants, you know, dependent on the whim and the mood, even, of their employer. There was mass unemployment, there was terrible maltreatment and exploitation at work. The lives of women without money were very, very hard to live indeed. Children were terribly maltreated at school. He manages to convey all that in the most extraordinary way. And yes, the challenge is indeed not to power. It's not an attack on those in power. It's a challenge to those who live under it to say, you know, are you willing to be treated like a sap all your life?
Don't just spit in the soup. Let's stand up and do something. Yeah. Christopher Hitchens, thank you for joining us tonight. It's been great having you.
It's very nice of you to host me.
Christopher Hitchens is columnist for Vanity Fair and author of Why Orwell Matters. Amity Schles, we've just got a second, but there's Orwell. He just won't go away.
Well, I'd like to say, think about the optimism of now. And what we do have that's different is we have central power like that is very hard to get. You only get it in totalitarian regimes. With the economy as strong as it is across the globe, even in a recession, we're a much more diffuse, optimistic world.
And much less easily dominated. Amity Schles, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Amity Schles is a senior columnist for the Financial Times. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. This is On Point. We all know about the first Thanksgiving. The pilgrims were there wearing their buckled hats, sharing a meal of turkey and cranberries with their new pals, the natives, right? Well, not quite. According to a new exhibit at Plymouth Plantation entitled Thanksgiving, Memory, Myth, and Meaning, Nancy Brennan is executive director of Plymouth Plantation, a living museum near the original Plymouth Rock. In this radio diary, she says that 400 years ago, the pilgrims didn't even think of their celebration in terms of giving thanks.
In 1621, the scene that you would have seen here of feasting and some playing of games and conversation between the colonists themselves and their families and the Wampanoag, all that would have been a harvest celebration as opposed to what they would have thought of as Thanksgiving. their notion of a Thanksgiving was tied to something far more solemn, in that there were traditions in England of days of humiliation and prayer and days of Thanksgiving. These groups of people, the Wampanoag and the Pilgrim, 90 Wampanoag and roughly 50 Pilgrims, of whom 30 or 35 were male colonists, adults. Only four European women were still alive and the rest were children. They provided for themselves what bounty they could gather from their own harvest and from the crops and the bounty of the woodland. We know from the account of the period that Bradford sent four men out fowling. They would have gathered ducks and geese as well as wild turkey. But then when Massasoit arrived, he sent his own men out to provide for this large group of people, and he provided deer for the this feasting. Other than that, what they would have had were from their own gardens and what the woodland provided. Cranberry sauce, by the way, while plentiful in New England, was far too tart to be used for anything without lots of sugar, and that was far too expensive. And for that matter, what we love now as cranberry sauce is about 100 or 150 years later in its invention. As far as pumpkin and pumpkin pies, yes, absolutely pumpkin, but no, no pumpkin pies. Pumpkin was much more commonly stewed with herbs like nutmeg, and it would have been the consistency of a little mushier than mashed potatoes. Black and black with buckles would not have been present, would have been missing the aprons and jackets and skirts would have been bright greens and russets and colors that would have been fashionable and present in England. There is no unbroken line between 1621 and our national holiday. That unbroken line starts for us in the 1840s when an amateur historian who was also a minister named Young rediscovered and reprinted the writing of Edward Winslow, wherein in a letter to his friend he was talking about life here in New Plymouth, and only 100 words of a very long letter were devoted to his recollection of what happened here in the fall of 1621 during the harvest celebration. But Reverend Young, in a footnote, he says, and this was the first Thanksgiving. It clicked. The New England tradition of the harvest celebration was blended with this notion of thanksgiving to God for his blessings. And 20 years later, as Lincoln fought to preserve the Union, after the successful Union victory at Gettysburg, he declared the fourth Thursday of Thanksgiving as a day of national thanksgiving for, as he said, and I quote, general blessings, quote, close quote. And that national holiday has stuck with us ever since.
Nancy Brennan is the executive director of Plymouth Plantation. The exhibit, Thanksgiving, Memory, Myth, and Meaning, is open through Sunday and will return next spring. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funding